Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Hockey Show here on 101.5 UMFM, Canada's only campus-produced radio show that strictly talks hockey. Glad to have you aboard tonight, everybody. Big guest with us tonight. Obviously, you're always excited to have guests in, but this gentleman coming back, give us a little bit of his time, is always great for us. I want to bring Jenna in. Jenna, how are you doing in terms of making it through this pandemic still?
I'm doing well, getting through it, I guess.
Good, yep. Good. Let's not waste any time, though, because we got lots to go over. We got lots to ask, some funny questions, some good stuff to go over with our guest tonight. So our guest tonight really needs no introduction, as his name alone is highly recognizable in hockey circles, but we'll still give him the proper seg that he deserves. His rich hockey history saw him play for the WHL's Medicine Hat Tigers, the Central Hockey League's Indianapolis Checkers, where he won a number of championships, and the NHL's New York Islanders, Los Angeles Kings, and San Jose Sharks. He has a 1993 Stanley Cup final appearance on his resume, and he was part of the 1987 Canada Cup team that won gold. And he's since become one of the most preeminent hockey broadcasters this great nation and this great sport has to offer. He last appeared on the show on April 9th, 2020, where we discussed his career, his work as an author for his book Calling the Shots, and his work in helping to bring awareness to mental health initiatives. It is truly a privilege and an honor to have him back on the show, and Jen and I are proud, humbled, and pleased to welcome Mr. Kelly Rudy back to the show. How's everything going, Kelly?
Holy, that's quite the intro. I was expecting the normal. Here is a crappy hockey player that's an equally bad broadcaster, but we're glad to have him back. So thank you. That's very kind, Trevor and Jen.
No.
Look forward to it again.
100%. We always are honored to have you on, and certainly we want to give you that honor and give you the respect you deserve for sure. So everybody doing safe though? Everybody safe in your household in terms of staying safe in this pandemic?
As best as possible, I think. I was talking to some friends not long ago, earlier today, and when we all had this conversation a few months ago when the pandemic first broke, I think a lot of us would say, okay, well, do you know anybody, any family or friends that have been stricken with the COVID-19 virus? And most often the answer would be no. Well, that's changed in, would you say April, when I was last on, that now we're able to say, not happily, by the way, that yes, our family's been affected. Virtually everybody that I know, they've been affected in some way by the virus. And so thanks for asking. We're doing okay. Everybody seems to be back on the road to good health, and I hope everybody in your families are doing okay and your close circle of friends as well.
Yeah, I think we're doing all right out here. I know, you know, Jenna's got a job that doesn't really let her avoid that kind of stuff. So, I mean,
right.
Hopefully it doesn't get worse for Jenna by any means. But as always, as we always do in our show, let's get into the questions. Jenna, I'm going to give you the honor once more. By all means, let's kick this thing off.
All right. So we're not going to go over all the stuff you've done as we did on the previous episode, and listeners can find that on the Hockey Blog in Canada. Today, though, we want to talk to you about everything happening in and around the NHL, because there's a lot. So first off, what did you think of the bubbles that the NHL operated in both Edmonton and Toronto? We both agree that it went pretty, you know, okay, all things considered. So we were just wondering maybe your thoughts on that.
Okay, I have a number of thoughts on that. First of all, as an outsider, most of my work was done out of my home office here in Calgary, and or in Toronto. I think I spent the last 18 nights of the Stanley Cup playoffs in Toronto doing the studio show. And from afar, I would have to say that I thought the bubble was tremendous. They did an amazing job, as all of us know. There were no positive tests. I it just looked perfect. It looked seamless. It looked like everybody was safe. Now, on the opposite end of that, when you dig deeper and when you hear people like Rick Bowness talk about the troubles that they had, and he was very emotional. I believe it was after the first round, by the way, of the playoffs, and he spoke candidly about the troubles that his team and he was having in the bubble and the, you know, sort of loneliness and the, you're missing your family and friends and you don't have that human connection that we all need. And so it was, I think at that point that it really occurred to me, especially as you mentioned, Trevor, the work that our family does with mental health, how difficult that must have been. And so Tuukka Rask, I believe, was the only player to leave for non-specific reasons, other than an injury or something. And I was quite shocked. Frankly, I thought there would be more players leaving the bubble based on mental health issues and concerns, not only for maybe their well-being mentally, but maybe concerns family members and so on. They're all young people with young families and how they're accepting of this, separation. So all those sorts of things. So I give, two varied accounts there. One, it looks like it's perfect. And the other is that, man, it's almost broken. And I think the second answer is the one that the NHL decided that moving forward, they can't do it again. They did it. It was amazing. They were able to award a Stanley Cup, but I think everybody recognized you can't do that again. And the players have no appetite for that, of which I would agree.
I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think that's a valid, very valid point, especially seeing Rick Bowness sort of break down there on the mm-hmm. press conference podium and really sort of talk about the struggles they were having. So it goes to the question then. Obviously I don't expect you to have an answer, up front, and you're probably not working with the NHL to figure this stuff out. But with the NHL proposing 14-day bubbles now and then going home for 14 days, obviously there's a greater risk now. The variable of getting sick is going to be much greater than what it was having, the bubble sort of wrapped up. So how would you see the NHL sort of balancing the two out of having that sort of, shorter bubble period, but with greater risk to a player maybe contracting the virus?
That's a great unknown. So we all expect that it's moving forward. Hopefully they can figure out their differences, the NHL and the PA, and work toward a resolution and get hockey back. But I think all of us do recognize, fingers crossed, that they're going to be able to pull this off to a certain degree, knowing that there will be some positive tests. That example and what you're talking about, how they're going to try and do this, there will be players that, test positive and hopefully it's not where it shuts down the league again. Now, I had a great conversation with Elliot Friedman about a week ago and talking about, some of the concerns, what's going on, what are they chatting about, what's going to happen. And I used to be a real avid sports fan. And because of my age and my family life, and, it's a little bit more difficult for me to follow all the other sports. And in particular, he told me, do you know much about college football? And I said, no, I used to, but I don't follow it all anymore. And he's telling me something like there's about 15 to 20 games a week that are canceled or postponed because of the pandemic. And I'm thinking, now, of course, there's a lot more teams and leagues and college football in the U.S., but I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, I wasn't aware of that. But that does suggest to me that if the NHL comes back here in hopefully January, maybe February, that there will be positive tests and there will be postponements of games. I see no way around it. I don't think anybody else does. And they're just going to try and minimize the risks if possible.
I mean, we were talking about this earlier. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. Just like we were talking, football, everything with having to cancel games or playing games and missing, almost half the team or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So that'll be interesting for sure. So during the last games in the bubble, obviously it was a little bit different for the players and maybe it might have affected it a bit. So what was maybe one thing that you noticed or maybe didn't notice as much when you were watching the games in the bubble?
I think the energy that the players get from the fans, I think that was pretty noticeable. I thought the NHL did an amazing job with their broadcast partners to try and interject some of that excitement and the noise and the cheering and some of that. By the way, I thought that was really cool. That blew me away. I didn't realize the depth of which they're going to try and replicate that fan involvement or fan experience. But I thought there were plenty of moments on the ice when I was maybe watching certain plays or players or in certain situations when something was, you know, just a remarkable play. And you can tell when the player gets a little bit of juice from the noise in the building and the fan reaction, whether the fans are jumping up on the glass and you feel that. And so I think they miss that. I think I miss that. But, all in all, I thought everybody did a great job with trying to sort of manufacture that enthusiasm. And that's what it was, you know. It's one thing to say that the importance of this game is this and it's this, and if we win this, we're going to move on to the next round. But it's another thing when you step on the ice to look around and see 18 or 20,000 people there. And that does give you a little bit of juice. I know often, and Jenna, I know you played also. And, you know, there's one thing sometimes, and it's not often in a playoff game, but certainly a regular season game, when you get on the ice and you don't have the same sort of motivation that you should. And one thing, one little trick I used to try and use to try and fool my brain was during the national anthem, I'd look up and I'd say, holy, isn't that cool? There's 18,000 people here to see me and my friends and the other team play, and they're spending their hard-earned money to do so. And so that was a tool I used, but these players couldn't do that. So they had to find other ways, again, to trick their brain and manufacture that enthusiasm that sometimes the fans just naturally give you.
I don't disagree. I think that was the one big thing that everybody, I mean, certainly when they talked to the players after, you know, the entire bubble situation was over, that's what they said, is they, you know, at times they couldn't even hear some of that piped in sort of crowd noise, right, or whatever.
Yeah.
I thought that the way that they sort of covered over all of the seats, all the empty seats, and made them sort of one big sort of panel, I thought that actually played to their benefit in that it didn't look like an empty arena anymore. It kind of just looked like a rink out there. And I thought they did a great job of that.
Absolutely. That and the video board. So
yeah.
Oh, I mean, whoever was behind that, the brains behind that, that was phenomenal. And they showed not only the replays and so on, but they had these heartwarming messages, or they had these heartwarming videos. You know, a player might score, and then you might see his family flash on the video board, and all these little things that I thought they really drove home the importance of family and friends, and, you know, how difficult it is. So I thought, you know, the way in which they, covered up the lower bowls was great. I think I'm pretty, you're getting the opinion of me anyways, that I was really, really impressed with everything they did. It just phenomenal. I had my doubts going into it. I really did. I thought that some of the players, because they're young, they might try and sneak out of the bubble or what have you, and there was just none of that. They're really dedicated athletes.
Speaking of looking a little different, though, I mean, obviously, Hockey Night in Canada had a bit of a different look with you and Cassie Campbell working from home. Did you like working from home during the playoffs? Was that something that you wanted to do and maybe want to see continue if it works out for you?
Well, that's an interesting question. I did like it. There's parts of it that I felt very natural and very comfortable, and it was certainly easier for my life because I just woke up in my own bed and I just walked down to my office and I go to work. And, you know, I think I only had one day where I had three games. So that was a long 12 or 14 hour day. Other than that, I usually only had two, or near the latter part of the playoffs, only one game. So that became quite easy until I went to Toronto. But the one thing you miss, there's no question about it, is the interaction with everybody else on the panel. And as you guys could tell, Cassie and I both had a delay in our feed. And so that was a little bit disconcerting, because there was one time in one of my earlier shows that Anthony Stewart and Kevin Bieksa were on the panel, I believe, with Ron, and there might have been somebody else, and they were having a little chat, and I tried to interject my two cents, but because of the delay, it just didn't work, and it kind of felt awkward, and we're all trying to stumble around. So I learned a lesson early on that I just, even though I wanted to say something from Calgary, I knew that 2 or 3 second delay, it would just sort of lose its effect. So you miss that. Now, having said that, when I went to Toronto and I did my thing, we were all separated. So other than Kevin and Ron on that main desk where they sort of had some interaction, all of us were separated. So we didn't really have that same feel that you would normally get when you're all at the same desk in that studio. So that also was a challenge. I'm expecting, since the numbers of the virus continue to rise across the country and across the states, that I would suspect, at least early on, I'll be doing most of my work out of my home office again, which I'm more than happy to do, and see if we can't do a really bang-up job and be as professional as possible. But under these circumstances, Trevor and Jen, I'm open to anything, and whatever ideas and recommendations they have, I'm willing to learn and adapt.
I'll be honest. I liked it. I thought that, you know, seeing the stuff behind you, all the stuff on your credenza, your desk and stuff behind you.
Cool. Thanks.
I thought it was cool. Cause I mean, you don't really get to sort of see that, you know, you get to, you know, the generic sort of, you know, studio look when you're in the studio, but you know, seeing that sort of, you know, window into your home office there was kind of cool. So.
Okay. So I have a little backstory to that. So when it was decided that Cassie and I, and even Colby, when he was, broadcasting from Pittsburgh, he was doing it out of his home, and we were given the green light to do whatever we wanted as our backdrop. So I had the conversation with my wife, and I thought, well, we both thought this would be kind of cool. We'll show some maybe family pictures, some different things in the background, and but you really struggle because Cassie had a nice clean background. I think Colby had the odd little tidbit that he changed up from time to time, and I thought, one of my bosses at Sportsnet said, and if you choose to, you can change that backdrop every day or weekly or what have you. And I had a great conversation with Ron McLean. I think we did a test run 2 or 3 days before we actually went to air. And he had the conversation with me about, that was one of the things years ago, I forget what was the problem, but it was CBC many years ago, and they were going to do home studios and so on. And they recommended you don't have anything behind you, otherwise people won't actually listen to your words. They'll just get fixated on the backdrop. And I had some family pictures. Like I said, I had a couple of honorary diplomas and so on. And so I took that to heart. I didn't want to take away those things, but I decided not to change it up. I don't think I may have changed it once during the course of the 6 weeks that I was in my office, simply because I didn't want that to be a distraction. Once you saw it a couple times, you were used to it. You knew what was in the backdrop. But moving forward, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to decorate it in a different way and try and, you know, show some of the cool things that I have in my office on display.
I'm all for it. Go for it. Cause I thought it was cool.
Yeah. I like that idea. It kind of gives, you know, listeners or people a little bit of an insight into you, get to know you a little bit without taking away, like you said, people are still listening to you. So
that's kind of my message, Jenna, even like on social media. I think most people know on Twitter and Instagram that I almost never talk about hockey. It's not that I don't like to, I do it tons, but I just want to give people sort of like a look into my life and what is important to me in those times. And so for me, it's usually what I'm having for dinner, where my wife and I might be golfing, or we just got back from Vancouver about a month ago for a little vacay after the playoffs, and or most importantly, mental health issues. So that gives a person an insight into who I really am. And it's a different look than just talking hockey all the time, which I still love and I do all the time, but I like to separate things.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I mean, speaking of getting to, you know, maybe know you or other people, I've always been a massive Cassie Campbell fan while she's playing. Sure. She was literally my idol, but I think she was obviously a tremendous player, and she's really gotten a lot better and continues to grow with her analysis of NHL hockey over the years. It's pretty clear she knows the game from playing at such a high level, but what is she like kind of behind the scenes? Is she a chatterbox with you guys when she's going over the notes? Is she more focused? What's she like?
Yeah, great question. So I've known Cassie since 2004, the summer of 2004, really. Like, I'd met her a couple times, but I worked with her and Scott Oak in a project. And by the way, a guy by the name of Scott Moore that founded Sportsnet many, many years ago, on a project called Bell Making the Cut. So it was this so-called reality television show where these hockey players that usually junior age players, or no, just a little bit older, or college players that just maybe some guys were drafted but didn't quite get into the pro game, or they're sort of floundered around. They're hoping to get a second chance. Anyways, I got to know Cassie there, and so I really enjoyed being around her. But then we really got to know each other on Hockey Night and Sportsnet over the years. And the one thing about Cassie is that when you're around her, in particular on game day, you recognize how hard she works. So this is not just handed to her. She works her butt off. She's diligent in finding out information behind the scenes. But also, I've gone out for dinner with her a few times. In particular, she worked twice on Saturday nights this past season. And so on a Friday night, her and I went out for dinner and we had a great time and a little bit of wine and just getting to know each other even better that way and becoming more friends and more supportive. And so that was great. But here's my favorite story about Cassie. And so at one point, maybe about a month into the pandemic, so it must have been in April at some point or something. And I'm one of the things, which was great during the pandemic, I started early and remains so to this day, I've been calling my mom every single day. And so it's a great habit I've gotten into. And, you know, I found in my old life, I was just getting too busy and I didn't call my mom as often as I should have. Anyways, I'm past that, and we're it's a beautiful thing. We look forward to our chats every day. But about a month into it, I'm talking to my mom, and she made a comment about Cassie. And, I go, well, haven't you met her, Mom? And she goes, no, but it's on my bucket list. So I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So I get off the phone with my mom and I text Cass and I say, hey, listen, I don't know when my mom's going to be able to make it. And I don't know when this pandemic is going to end and lockdown and so on. And I said, would you mind maybe calling my mom? And she goes, I can do better. Does your mom have FaceTime? So yeah. And so they set it up. And Cassie took 45 minutes to chat with my mom on FaceTime. And I just, you know, it's so heartwarming. And you think, going way out of her way, it's not just a quick 2-3 minute phone call. Hi, Mrs. Rudy, how are you? And so on. They really chatted about life and things. And my mom was so grateful.
That's phenomenal. I mean, good on Cassie for doing that.
Right?
That's amazing. I love that. Wow.
Let's take a look a little bit deeper then on that, not so much of Cassie, but just sort of in general then. We've seen 8 women have their names etched onto the Stanley Cup already, Kelly. I mean, we've seen several high-profile women added as coaches to various NHL teams this year and certainly in the front offices. We have yet to see a woman sit as either an assistant GM or a GM in this league. And I'm not asking you for names. You don't need to name anybody specifically. But are we close to having a woman run a team as a general manager after finding out that Angela Ruggiero, for example, was interviewed by the Florida Panthers for their vacancy?
Oh yeah, it's inevitable. I look forward to those days. You have to remember, you're talking to a guy that has 3 daughters. So
right, yeah,
right. So I'm always looking for opportunities or situations where everybody's included. It doesn't matter gender or race or what situation you're in. So I think it's going to happen. I think what we've noticed, say, in the last 3 to 4 years is more progress in that side of it. So super exciting. I know that I've shared many flights with Haley Wickenheiser between Calgary and Toronto, because as you guys know, she's in player development with the Leafs. And yeah. So she and I have had conversations before boarding the plane about what's going on and her role and so on. I think she travels, well, in last year anyways, I think she was traveling twice a month to Toronto, which I don't know how she does it while she's trying to become a doctor at the same time. But, you know, and I think of Cami Granato and her role with Seattle and many other women out there that are finally getting the opportunity. And it's a great thing.
I know I'm excited to see, you know, what comes in the next couple of years, because it's definitely, it's getting there. We're getting a lot closer to it for sure. And I think just women in general, the sports world are starting to make more names for themselves. Are starting to get more into those higher up positions, which is really nice to see.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about time. Like I said, I first got to know Cassie in 2004, and I'd fire questions her way and ask her opinion about what she thinks about this player or a particular play or, you know, what have you. And that's also one of the things that I appreciate about a person like Cassie, that because of my schedule so busy, she's been able to take over some of my workload during Flames broadcasts. And it's not just because she's a woman that it's great. It's because I think the Flames fans get a different perspective of how all of us see the game a little bit differently, right? Like it's no different than one of my favorite things when I used to be a player. We'd go out on flew into Chicago on a Wednesday. We played there Thursday night, and Wednesday night we'd all go for, 10 of us would go for dinner, and we'd sit around a table having a steak and a glass of wine, and we'd talk about Chicago, the opponent, the next night, and we'd all have a different opinion about particular players. And that's my point about when Cassie joins the show, she might see the game a little bit differently. And I think that's a great perspective for our fans, because if we all had the same opinion, it'd be boring and it wouldn't have any use. And so I just think that the direction the game's going is so exciting.
Yeah, we wouldn't have this show, that's for sure. So
So speaking of perspective a little bit, you guys kind of had a breakout star join the panel this season as Kevin Bieksa brought a new perspective to the analysis while being a bit of a comedian at the same time. Did you know Kevin before he joined the team, and what did you think of his abilities in breaking down a game?
Well, he was phenomenal. He had a great start, which did not surprise me 1%. In fact, many years ago when I used to work, I would say exclusively out west, Tim Davis was our producer of Hockey Night in Canada out west, and he would get our guests along with Scott Oak. Scott Oak was a big part of rounding up the guests also. And they worked on getting Kevin because we kind of knew his demeanor a little bit as a player when he was with the Canucks. But, you know, when you talk to people, you really get a behind the scenes look at what he's kind of like. And so we asked him to come on after hours, and I thought he was pretty good, but he ran into Tim Davis in Yale Town at a coffee shop about a week or two after doing the show. And he said, "I apologize. I was so nervous that my real personality didn't shine, and I'd like an opportunity to come back on." And I thought that was really cool that, you know, he recognized what I think is the importance of that show and how it connects players with the fans. And I think that show does a wonderful job of making that show real Canadiana, and that attachment between all of us as Canadians that really admire and respect the hockey players, and but not just as people on the ice, but who they are. And so Kevin came on the next time and he was lights out. And then I think we had him on two or three more times, or maybe more, but at least while I was on the show with Scott Oak. And I remembered I called Kevin's agent after I think his second appearance on After Hours. And I called him and I said, "Hey, Kurt, your client is my favorite all-time guest on After Hours." And I wasn't being gratuitous. I wasn't embellishing, or I was telling the truth. And having said that, Trevor and Jenna, we've had amazing guests over the years. Like, I'm so blown away by how gracious these players are and have been. But I just thought Kevin was at a different level. And so when he had that start to his playoffs, I was not surprised. I think we had him on, didn't we, during the regular season two or three times, I believe.
A couple times, yeah.
And so we knew that he was going to be great. By the way, we also had other great guests, like Mike Camilleri was outstanding. I think he was on our first show of the year. And so it's kind of cool to see how these guys come in and our last comments about a different perspective and just add something to the show. And it's been really fun.
Speaking of the playoffs, I mean, obviously Tampa Bay won, kind of did what everybody finally expected them to do in terms of winning the Stanley Cup. Obviously, we've heard the stories, whether they're true or not, about how, you know, Gretzky and the Oilers learned to win after losing to the Islanders in that early sort of stage of their career. You've been through some tough series as well in your career, Kelly, and the old adage is basically repeated every year. One has to learn how to lose before one can win. So how much do you think the Columbus sweep 2 years ago kind of led to what Tampa Bay did this year?
I think it was instrumental in them winning the cup this year. And one of my favorite lines was Vasilevskiy. And he said, going into these playoffs, it wasn't that we need to be better. He said, "And I learned I needed to be better." And that's quite the statement when you're looking at yourself, you know, in particular, when you're such an accomplished goalie like he is. And he recognized that he was maybe the weak link in that Columbus playoff series. And he needed, even with all the accomplishments, he needed to find a way to become a better goalie. And man, he was magical to watch. But I think also, you know, maybe to a certain degree, the previous year, it just was too easy. And all of us know the regular season, it can never be easy. It's got to be hard. It's got to be hard mentally. It's got to be hard physically for you to really learn some lessons and understand how far both, again, mentally and physically, you can push your body, because it's an extreme grind. And I would say what most fans don't recognize, when you're playing an 82-game schedule, and it doesn't matter if you were playing in the 60s with that kind of game, or in the 80s with the style of play then, or in today's game, purely a skill game with very little contact, most players' bodies start to break down in around early November, and at some point you're finding way with the medical staff to get you back on the ice every single game and for practices, because you're so beaten up. And so when you look at the grind that Tampa put themselves through this year, there was one extra round for them, a play-in round or an exhibition, a round robin, and it might have been the most grueling Stanley Cup playoffs ever on record. And so it's a phenomenal feat. They deserved it. They found ways to get through situations. Like Braden Point is a great example. That's exactly what I'm talking about. A guy that most likely would have needed surgery or extensive time off, yet he was able to find a way to get back on the ice with the medical staff.
I can't imagine what their bodies must go through during those seasons. Cause even just like I played university and I mean, there's nowhere near as many games, but by the end of the season, your body is beat up and needs a break. So it's crazy.
And how many games did you guys play? You were at Grant McEwen for 2 years?
I played there for 4 years.
That's right.
Yeah. That's bad. I don't even know, but probably around, I'd say 30-ish games.
Right.
So you guys were at like 24 games a season plus playoffs.
Yeah, and then playoffs, I think.
Right. And so, and with going to school and some travel and so on, so you know the drill. You know how difficult it is. And and you guys would have played only on weekends. Is that correct?
Yeah, we played weekends.
Yeah. And that's similar to what I played in the minors. So when I played in Indianapolis, and it's a whole different mindset, right? Because we didn't play a lot of weekday games simply because you can't get a lot of people in the building. So most of as many games as possible we'd have on weekends. And that would include three Friday, Saturday, and Sunday if possible. And it's a different mindset. I was lucky because I kind of learned that in junior to play, you know, three games in a row, as opposed to the NHL life, it's back to back and maybe three and four at times. So it's what you have to do mentally to challenge your body to get through it. And then of course, you know, if your body's at its limit, then you have to take time away.
Yeah, for sure. So NHL proposed a 48-game schedule that would start in January. We kind of touched on this before, but as it stands, the Canadian teams would be stuck playing each other due to border crossing restrictions and like the massive COVID outbreaks in the NFL who are traveling each week. On top of that, this week alone, the Mount Royal Cougars men's team have 18 positive tests. Mm-hmm. The Canadian World Junior team selection camp has been put on hold due to positive tests. The Vegas Golden Knights and Columbus Blue Jackets have reported outbreaks at their facilities. And the QMJHL is still struggling with any kind of season due to the red zones across Quebec. Should hockey fans even be hoping for an NHL season at this point with everything that's happening surrounding the pandemic?
Wow, you laid it out pretty well there, Jenna. That doesn't sound promising, does it? Here I've been trying to convince myself the last 2 weeks I have to start getting ready and do more reading and watching videos and getting ready for the upcoming season. Now I think I need a beer and just sort of chill out. But no, I'm making light of it. But no, I'm pretty certain there will be a season. I don't know when that start date will be. I'm hoping middle of January, but I could see at some point in February. But I do think they're going to pull this off. I hope, you know, part of the responsibility, it's not just the leagues, and you mentioned all of them and particular teams. some of this falls on us, the citizens. We've got to be good, right? We've got to be socially responsible, and we still have to wear our masks, and we have to keep our distance, and we can't have family over, and we can't have, you know, private gatherings, even though we feel the fatigue of the virus and what's going on. And I think so. A lot of it has to do with what society decides to do. And I know that's kind of a heavy answer, but it's partially true. If society decides that they've had enough of social distancing and wearing masks and I don't care and so on, well, then, you know what? The league might not be able to start up.
I mean, we talk about it usually at least once a week on this show about wearing masks and social distancing, and totally. It comes down to, red zones aren't for the NHL. Red zones are for society to be safe. So yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And we all have to make sacrifices. I mean, we love our little grandson, and we're going to be grandparents again in February. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And we so desperately want to see all of our children and husbands and partners and so on. But, you know, what? The last month we've been trying to do the absolute right thing, and we have not seen our little grandson in just over a month, and it breaks our heart. And we drop things off on their front porch, and we kind of get a glimpse of them through the window or through the open door and so on. But you know, that's not living that we want, but we have to sacrifice, and everybody's in the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that'll happen, because obviously, knock on wood, February and a new addition to the family is always exciting.
Right? So, oh my gosh! And then I can just watch my bank account go down because because Nanny's going to continue to buy more clothes and little outfits and so on, which I love. I mean,
yeah, I was going to say you need the season to start if that's the case, right? So.
We went shopping today, and my wife bought little Maverick more books and things, and it just melts my heart every time.
No, that's so awesome. That's fantastic that, you know, things are still on the up and up for you guys, because that's always good to hear. Yeah. So
I'm going to switch up the topic a little bit here, just something we've been talking about quite a bit the last couple of weeks. So the NHL and Adidas rolled out some new merchandise with 31 new jerseys. We were both kind of meh for the most part. I say meh every single time, but there are a couple that were okay, a couple that were pretty bad. Were there any that caught your eye for being either really good or really bad?
Okay, so when I received the text from you guys talking about some of the talking points and so on, I saw the reverse retro jerseys, and I have to admit, I don't normally pay attention to that stuff because I don't really care, but so I'm looking on my cell right now, and I'm looking at the jerseys. I had it saved just for this conversation.
Okay.
And for the most part, I think I like basically 25, 26 of them, but there are a couple that I really don't like, and I never have. And I'm not a big fan of the Anaheim one, going back to their early days. And I kind of liken it to that same time when I played for the Kings, and
right,
and we had those terrible jerseys. I think they're nicknamed the Burger King jerseys.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. If you've not looked at those, Google it and look. Those were horrible. I remember all of us putting that jersey on before our warm-up, that particular first game we're playing, and we're all laughing like, this is horrible. Like, we have one of the coolest jerseys in the entire league, those beautiful black and silver and white jerseys, and we're wearing this thing? Like, it was awful. And that's why I don't like the Anaheim one. I was never a fan of Arizona / Phoenix jersey that they're rolling out again. I never liked that initial design. And I, even though I might get in trouble for this, I've never liked the flaming horse head on the flame, right? I like the color scheme. I just don't like the flaming horse head. Those are the ones that I think really stand out to me that I don't like, but some I absolutely love. Like, I'm a huge fan of the Hartford Whalers. I love that, the color scheme. And I don't think I really appreciated it when I played against Hartford, but that jersey, and that, of course, is for Carolina. But the Colorado Avalanche with the Nordique take is perhaps my favorite. And I don't know if it's just simply because I love what it looks like or because of my fond memories of going to Quebec City and playing, and playing in the Colisée, and they had the best hot dogs, bar none, in the league. And I like that. I really like the New York Ranger one because of the Statue of Liberty. It reminds me of, well, that was a great jersey they had, but it also reminds me of the great artwork that Mike Richter had on that mask and the Statue of Liberty. And that was just so simple, but pure and great. I was never a fan of those early New Jersey, the green ones, but when I look at it now, I kind of like it.
Would you wear the purple and gold Kings jersey with the 90s LA logo on it with a little more enthusiasm than pride than the Burger King alternates? Like, would that one
come
be?
Come on, Trev. You know I skipped over because I don't like it.
Okay, that's fair. No, that's entirely fair.
No, you know, it's funny, though, because I love the uniforms we had when Gretzky was there. Those stood out to me. I know that they were, I thought, tremendous. But it's interesting because there's still a huge following of Kings fans that prefer those purple jerseys. And there's, I don't know, it never did grab my attention, but I certainly appreciate that they like it. And that certainly is a tradition. And if you want to go traditional, that's the heart of it for the Kings.
Jenna likes the Calgary Flaming Horse.
Oh, do you?
I despise it.
I'm the only one. Nobody else.
We had Delaney Bryan on last week, and she hates it too, so don't feel bad.
I was listening to talk radio here in Calgary when they announced it, and there were a lot of people calling in saying that's the jersey they grew up on, and they loved it, and that's maybe their favorite. And so I get it. Like, you know, I do like the color scheme, just the fire coming out of the horse head I kind of have a bit of a problem with, but
yeah,
understandably so. I'm old.
What do you think of the Jets one? Are you okay with the gray, the charcoal gray?
Yeah, I'm trying to get used to it. You know, the one thing I kind of struggle with at times, when you have a really beautiful traditional jersey like the Jets have, you know, it's hard to come up with something new that somebody might go, you know what, that's pretty good, you know, because I just like the traditional jersey of the Jets, and there's not much really to play around with. It's kind of, there's a few jerseys out there that are just really, really stand alone and you don't need much, like Detroit, Chicago, the original six teams. Those are jerseys that for the most part it's hard to mess with, and even though Winnipeg's relatively new in their second time here in the NHL, I just always thought they got it right with their jerseys.
That's entirely fair. I just don't like the gray. I think that they could have done There was a guy on Twitter who did it in light blue, and it looked 100 times better. I thought they would have gone light blue instead of the gray, it would have really, really made that jersey pop a little bit more. But
right. I wouldn't disagree with that.
It'll be interesting to see that, you know, with that, what it would look like with a full uniform, not just the jersey. So.
Yeah, that's fair enough, because the pants and socks, right? Like, it's the full complement. That's where you sort of get the idea of it, right? So I think you're right about that, Jenna.
I'm going to ask a question, because I think this, I think that there was a lot of social media chatter about this, but certainly I thought it was one of the better things that I saw the entire playoff broadcast that you guys did. But Kelly, you spoke out on August 26th on the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast that night about how the NHL missed an opportunity to show some real humanity and cancel games following a number of the Black Lives events that happened that day, and certainly in the previous couple of days. Did you take any heat for that? Like, did anybody give you any sort of blowback about what you said on the broadcast, going like, hey, like, Kelly, we gotta watch what you're saying here?
Yeah, that was a complicated day, and I appreciate you bringing it up and allowing me a chance to go back and sort of reminisce and go through what I was going through that day. I believe might have been the day before that broadcast, and I kind of had my eye on what the NBA players were talking about. And I think there was just a tiny bit of conversation about maybe boycotting games. And I went to bed that night, and the next day it picked up a lot of momentum. And I don't know if the players in the NBA had already announced that there was going to be a boycott, or the momentum had picked up to a point where I thought, I'm going to really start to pay attention to this. So I called David Amber, and David was a great source of inspiration for me, and also a person that I needed to talk to He being a person of color and knowing that we had this deep friendship anyways, but I needed to understand more. So it goes back a few months before that when George Floyd was murdered, and I went on social media and I posted a clip about how disgusted I was and, you know, mad and hurt and all those feelings I was having. And I promised in that video after George Floyd was murdered that I wanted to learn more. And so I was proud to say that, you know, my family, we've sat down many, many times over the course of dinner the last 2 years and had this conversation about Black Lives Matters and other important topics in our family and my wanting to learn and change. And so we now, again, fast forward to that day, and I had the conversation with David Amber about, here's what I'm feeling, here's what I feel like moving forward, and it's not that I don't want to have this discussion on national television, it's just that I don't know if I've come to the point where I'm comfortable or if I feel that I haven't learned enough yet to be a voice or express myself. And so as the day wore on, I continued, David and I had texted each other a number of times, and about an hour and a half before going to air, I had expressed my concerns with some of my production people, two producers in particular that mentioned to me, I can take the night off if I'm uncomfortable going to air, or if I choose to go to air, they'll support me in whatever I say. And so I really thought long and hard about it. And it was my wife about half an hour before going to air. She said that, well, if you don't go to air, people will just think that you weren't due to work that night and you don't have an opinion. And she was right. And so I went down in my office and I gathered my strength and I just spoke from the heart. And, you know, I will say this, I had a lot of positive feedback, but I didn't know what my employer would truly think. And so I woke up the next day to three incredible messages from my bosses, the big, big, big bosses, putting their support behind me, no matter what the backlash might have been. And so I was relieved with that. And I knew I had done the right thing. I still stand by it. I spoke from the heart, and you can never go wrong if you speak from the heart. And, you know, I look at it from, I was taught this by Shirelli Najak, a beautiful friend of mine, and he and I have worked together for years and years. And he taught me that you can come at things from either two places, a black heart, which is one of hate, or a red heart, which is love. So that was it, right? I just laid it on the line, and I know I got slaughtered from some people in social media, but who cares, right? If you're doing the right thing, who cares about those people? And it wasn't for me to try and change them. I just spoke about what I felt about that day. And I thought the opportunity was lost from the NHL, that we could have had those opportunities with our families to sit down and chat.
I mean, I wrote a piece on Hockey Blog in Canada about it. I basically said that you were right in everything that you said. So I was only asking because I thought, you know, everybody who's sort of in media, you know, has shots taken at them just because, you know, you're one way or the other, right? And that's where I was kind of like, you didn't really deserve it. So I want to give you a chance to sort of clear the air there and explain what happened. And if anybody, you know, from higher up, like you said, your bosses or anything kind of came and said, Kelly, you know, that, you know, we got to watch what we're saying sort of thing. But I'm glad that they supported you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that was great. But I have to tell you, the support I had from my family is more important, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, 100%. And I mean, credit to your wife, Donna, for you know, for convincing you that going on the air was the right thing to do as well. So good on her.
People thought I had overstepped my bounds or stick to your lane and all those dumb sayings that people have. That was, I think, the first sort of non-hockey political statement I had ever made in my life. And I was super comfortable with it. And I still to this day am. And that's not just Black Lives Matter. That's this entire movement about inclusion and all these things that all of us have to be better with.
Yeah, no, I'm 100%. We're both on board with that. I mean, like I said, we both thought it was great. So thanks for doing that, number one. And number two,
bring it up.
Yeah, thanks for not being scared to do it either. So that's awesome. So
It was an important day in my life. It's one that may go down as the most memorable broadcasting experience I've ever had.
Well, that's awesome.
And talking, you know, about speaking from the heart, or, you know, just saying what you need to say and, you know, not really caring. I love that. So just wondering when book number two comes out, since you must have enough material.
Interesting question, Jenna, because I started to get restless ballpark about a month ago, and I'm starting to jot down some notes. And now I'm not suggesting there's a book coming out within the next couple of years, but I'm now gathering thoughts again, and it's going to be an entirely different book. Of course, most of it would include my work broadcasting, as well as a large part of it about mental health and how it's affected our family and many of our friends and the discussions we're having around that topic. So I look forward to that day. I will tell you this, that writing a book is it's hard to do, and I can relate. You know, it's tiresome, it's emotional, and I really related to Brian Burke when he released his book, and he said, I remember for the last couple of years, maybe 3 years, Brian had been telling me that he had been doing a number of chapters on his own, and then when it was finally time to sort of go to a publisher, they told him, well, it's written too much like a lawyer and not as much as a book. And, you know, you kind of scrap that. And I believe his ghostwriter might've been Stephen Brunt, I think he partnered with, whom happens to be a great writer and so on. But my point is, you know, that's what I did. It was in the lockout of 2012. And I sat in my office and I wrote, jeepers, 5 or 6 or 7 chapters. As it turns out, maybe they had a basis of a chapter, but they were so poorly written and, you know, that you need somebody to help you. And I had Kirsty, luckily, McClellan Day, to help me. But, you know, it's a huge undertaking. And although I'm really proud of the book and the stories I told, it's not as easy as you would think.
Oh, no, I cannot imagine that being very easy, honestly.
I was going to say, I enjoyed it. I thought Calling the Shots was a fantastic book. So you
thanks,
did.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
But whatever first. Whatever I say, whatever framework you wrote and whatever, you know, Kirsty sort of, you know, improved upon or added to, I mean, it was good to start with. So
you got to come outside yourself, right, a little bit. So my book, Calling Shots, is not a tell-all. It's not a get-even, but I think there are 3 or 4 people in the book that I take a run at. And simply based on my life in hockey for all those years, that you can't get along with everybody. That would be a facade. And so, and I didn't want to bury people either. Like, there are other people that I really dislike that I've met in the game that I make no mention of.
Right.
But there are also things you have to step outside your own comfort zone. Like, when I share my experience about my episode, my mental health episode in Milwaukee in 92, 93, that was the last chapter that Kirsty and I had written. I had struggled with that because our beautiful daughter Caitlin has shared her story with thousands of people, if not maybe millions, you know, online and so on. And here I wasn't courageous enough to share that part of what I went through in 92, 93. And so I shared that with Kirsty, and then I had her print off that last chapter, and I met Donna and Caitlin at Earl's in Calgary, and I showed that last chapter to them, and my wife knew I was dealing with something, but I had never really opened up and properly told her what my struggles were at the time. And so it was really cathartic, I guess, at parts, and just get it off your chest and live life again.
I mean, like I said, the book itself turned out great. And I mean, yeah, I mean, it's great to see somebody, I mean, between you and I read Clint Larchuk's book as well about going through some of the stuff that he dealt with. And I mean, it's nice to see, and I'm not trying to sort of frame this negatively, but it's nice to see that, you know, your heroes have some, you know, some of the same things that we deal with, right? I mean, as regular people. So you guys are not these, you know, superheroes that are invincible. There are some things, and it's nice to sort of have that for people who are dealing with it to be able to relate to that, which I think is great. So
okay, so Clint and I like chatting about this. So Clint and I knew each other, I believe. Well, he grew up in Grand Prairie, Alberta, but he moved to Edmonton around 5 or 6 years old. And he moved to the same community I was living in, a place called Elmwood. So we've known each other for ballpark. We're both going to be 60 years old this coming year. So we've known each other for 54, 55 years. And I knew a lot about Clint's childhood and some of his struggles, because they were obvious to us going to school. I mean, he took I think, and he shares this in the book, so I'm not speaking out of school, but I think in grade six, he missed something like 3 weeks. We were told he was in the hospital because he had ulcers. Well, I knew a little bit about ulcers, but not much. Yeah. But I thought that was unusual, and I wondered if there was something else going on. Of course, it turned out to be his having some issues mentally. But, and I, Clint and I had always remained really good friends, and I knew a lot of what he had gone through, and he had shared with me about his suicide attempt long before it had become public. But even with all that info I had known, I got to tell you, I didn't know all of it. I didn't know the depth of his misery and what he had gone through and how hard he had worked to try and get his life back on track. And I remember flying out to Winnipeg, in fact, a number of summers ago when he sent me an advanced copy of the book. And I was flying out to Scott and Ann Oak's golf tournament for in support of their son, Bruce, that had lost his life to drug addiction. And I'm reading the book on the way to Winnipeg, and I remember sitting in a window seat and tearing up and thinking, oh my gosh, I had no idea Clint was in such trouble at that point. And I remember calling him or texting him saying, oh my gosh, but I'm so sorry I missed all the signs. But boy, he's brave, man, sharing that story, and good on him. He changed lives. Like, people, I think it's maybe the most honest sports book ever written.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I read it, you know, cover to cover basically in about a day, because I was just, like, you're always going, like, it's got to get better for him as you're reading the book, right? So I just kind of, like I said, it was kind of shocking to sort of read through and go, holy smokes. Like,
I can tell you he's doing really well.
Good. That's good to hear,
I just spoke to him a few days ago. He in fact, is fighting the COVID right now, but he's getting better. And I want to let, you know, your listeners know Clint is in a really good place in his life. And he and his wife, Joni, they have a ranch in Nevada. He's doing just really well.
Good. That's good to hear. And I mean, hopefully, knock on wood, the COVID doesn't slow him down anymore as well. We're basically out of time already, Kel. It didn't seem like it.
Wow.
It's been 15 minutes and it's actually been an hour. So I do want to say, from both Jen and I, give our best to Donna, obviously, and to your daughters and your extended family then. And you all have a great Merry Christmas and happiest of holidays this year. Because, I mean, yeah, I don't think we'll get to talk to you before December, but we want to see you back on TV soon. So let's hope hockey comes back. So,
well, we appreciate that. Donna was listening. She's doing a puzzle. And we send our best to both you, Trevor, and Jenna, and your families and friends and everybody listening. And let's get through the holidays. Let's, partake a little bit in some good cheer and just spread love. And let's treat each other well.
Absolutely. That's the greatest message that we've got. And certainly we'll keep in our thoughts over the holiday season as well, Kel. Thanks again for doing this. Again, if you ever want to come back, by all means, again, door will always be open for
you. Anytime. You know how to reach me, and make sure that you just send out an invite and we'll make it happen. I loved it. It was awesome.
Will do. That's awesome. So there is the one, the only Kelly Rudy of Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet. Obviously, we are extremely grateful for any of the time that he gives us, as he is, and he always will be, one of the best to have ever graced this show's presence, and we're always grateful for the time he gives us. So big thank you to Kelly Rudy for his appearance today. And we heard Kelly talk about it. Wear your mask, social distance, don't gather, be smart. Let's get over this. Let's get through this. Let's get back to normal. Let's make sure that we are doing our parts and acting responsibly here, because really, I mean, sports doesn't function in a non-functioning society. We can't have sports without a functioning society. And right now our society is not doing that. So let's get it together. Let's get ourselves back on track here, folks. And we'll certainly maybe see some hockey in 2021, certainly at the NHL level, but possibly at the local level as well, which would be fantastic to see. With that, folks, we're going to get out of here for another week. Stay tuned. Free Range Radio with Skippy coming up next here on the station, on the frequency. We're going to get out of here a little bit more. Here's the Struts. Put your hands up live on 101.5 UMFM. It's the Hockey Show. We'll see you next Thursday, everybody. Have a good one.